Back together again, you and I kicking it off. Brand new week, brand new month, Monday, March 2nd, 2026 on Connecticut Today, where we took a detailed look at the U.S.-Israeli joint attacks on Iran over the previous weekend. I offered my thoughts on what could happen, and also we welcome back University of New Haven Professor of National Security, Dr. Howard Stouffer, to the show for his perspective on the Middle East as well. Landmark Legal Foundation Vice President of Legal Affairs Mike O'Neill broke down oral arguments for a key and interesting U.S. Supreme Court case regarding gun ownership and marijuana use. Finally, Republican State Rep. Greg Howard had the latest from the state capitol.
Well, all I know is this had better work. I'm serious about this. This whole thing, this had better work, because if it doesn't, wow. This had better work. I'm not surprised this happened. Listen, you don't move those amounts of ordnance and military force into the area to just scare somebody and then turn around and then think that somebody you scared just won a standoff. You don't do that. Now, I know there were people saying, well, you know, the U.S. and Iran, they were making progress in talks. Come on, that's a smokescreen from both sides. But the bottom line is this. This had better work. Now, as we get into the discussion on this, and hi, how are you? Let's be careful here to understand what we're talking about. This is not a video game. This is not a card game. This is not a board game. This stuff is serious. And not that we haven't been through the seriousness of something like this going back to just post 9/11 in Libya, in Iraq, in Afghanistan, and now in Iran. So everybody knows that, but boy, I got to tell you again, this had better work. Look, the best case scenario here, and let's not paint with rose-colored glasses on here. You know, the Shah of Iran and now his son, who's the exile prince, the Shah in waiting, the king in waiting, whatever, he's sounding like a nice guy. Okay, I get it. I understand that. But his father was not the nicest guy, but he was a sometimes bad guy that aligned himself with the U.S. and actually, for the most part, allowed, geez, I don't know, a woman to be a woman. And not subjugating women like they're pieces of meat or pets on leashes. So when you look back, as I just was earlier this morning, at some of that old 1970s film of Iran, you can understand why these people want to breathe free. And you saw all these demonstrations and celebrations over the weekend around the world, here in the U.S., in big cities, and you saw some of the counter demonstrations here. But boy, let me say this again. This had better work. Now, is it more likely to work because of the stuff you heard today from President Trump and Defense Secretary, or Secretary of War, I guess it technically is now, Pete Hegseth? Is it more likely to work? Are we going to bring such overwhelming force that we batter the IRGC and all these other spawned groups off into the ground? Maybe, maybe not. But remember, as we found in Iraq and Afghanistan and all our other foreign entanglements, there is a religious theme here. And when you are fighting somebody that you perceive as oppressors, it's not easy to make people wither away and die. Sometimes it takes longer. That's primarily why the Japanese in World War II had to see the devastation of two nuclear bombs before they would let them do something that societally and in the Japanese frame of mind was never thought of not fighting till the death. The Germans wised up a couple of months earlier. We saw that in World War II. Took Japan, unfortunately, to see the destruction of two big cities and then the lingering effects of radiation poisoning to then say, okay, we've had enough. The heck with our tradition. We surrender. Is that going to happen in the Middle East? I don't know. I don't know. Now, let's not let's not beat around the bush here, if you'll excuse the phrase. Not the Iranian people, not the great people of Iran, used to be called Persia, and there's rumbling right now that if this sticks, it'll revert back to Persia, whatever. Wonderful cultural history, religious history, whatever. Okay. But let's not completely brush aside the fact that this is a regime that just killed 30,000 people, whatever. And I understand there are people who would say, well, if they want to kill their own people, why stop them? I get it. I understand it. I don't, not that I believe in that, but I understand the, some people would say, isolationist feelings or the feelings of, hey, this is just not of our business. Well, is it or is it not? And this is the stuff I want to discuss with you today. And we'll get underway. You know how to get a hold of us. Phone or otherwise, at 203-333-9422. 333-WICC. The guy, I would say gals, but no, they don't let women do anything like that in Iran. The guys that run Iran are ruthless thugs. We know that. They just killed 35,000 estimated of their own people. This happens every so often. Every 5 or 6 or 8 or 10 years, the people rally enough, they go in the streets, thousands are in the streets, and sadly, the people who in some warped way see themselves as fulfilling some sort of, you know, destiny here, kill people to stay in power. And there are people who would say, well, yeah, but regime change has to come peacefully. Now, not that I'm the biggest guy in for regime change, but come on, what are the odds that's going to happen in Iran or anywhere like it? See, I'm just laying out the arguments for and against here, but I will circle back and say this had better work. Because if it doesn't, man, oh, man, we may be in for a long slog. What did Nostradamus say? Or some people, there's all this biblical prophecy about the Middle East, and somebody is supposed to be Trump, and somebody is supposed to be the Ayatollah, and the fires here are supposed to be the attacks there. You know what I mean? So let us start with this, shall we? A basic question. I think it's easy enough to contemplate here at 203-333-9422, 333-WICC, and or Facebook.com/VoiceOfCT. How do you feel about this? And the rule for today is nobody's going to be right or wrong, because we can't be right or wrong, because we have no idea how this is going to end. We just don't. But there are certain things that certain people are saying, and I'm saying, oh, wait a minute. So we'll go from there, and we'll start it right here at 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. Do you approve of the military strikes against Iran? Will it bring a positive change or not? You tell us.
Missiles capable of hitting Europe and our bases, both local and overseas, and would soon have had missiles capable of reaching our beautiful America.
Are you buying that? 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. And by the way, there's going to be no right or wrong on today's program, right? No right or wrong, right? Wrong, Paul. No, seriously, because again, we have no idea how this is going to end. We don't. And any expert that tells you that, if they don't say, well, this is a possibility or that's a possibility or whatever, we're really not sure, they're not being honest. But what are your thoughts on this? When you saw this yesterday, actually wasn't yesterday, I'm sorry, it was early on Saturday. When you saw this early on Saturday, what were your thoughts? I wasn't surprised at all. And I can understand people. I've talked to some people already yesterday and today who were very upset with this. Other people I've talked with who were essentially saying, well, listen, let's just get it over with now and see if we can, you know, stop the killing again. Look, this is, and again, this is not to besmirch the good Persian people, the people of Iran. It's not. but their government since the Iranian Revolution in, you know, 47 years ago? It's been death to America, death to Israel, death to this one, death to that one, and for about 10 or 20 years, right? You just sat there and you watched, but now is the ongoing debate as to whether they have functioning nuclear weapons or not. Now, a lot of people are saying, well, this is the same thing as weapons of mass destruction, right? Colin Powell during the Bush years, former President George W. Bush. Yeah, and listen, if you hear somebody draw that comparison, can you blame them? With all the revisionist history that we've had here? 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. Two of our seven congressional delegation members have been very vocal about this. You'll hear it on Chris's News coming up. Also, I have the cuts for you of Jim Himes, and Jim Himes being one of the Gang of Eight. Jim Himes is the ranking Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee. So, you know, he was on with Melissa this morning, and he laid it out. He kind of knew something was happening, but under penalty of law and penalty of Congress, threat of censure and all that, he couldn't say anything. And, you know, people in Congress, when they get to certain levels of power, if they're the Gang of Eight with Homeland Security or intelligence or whatever and leadership, they have to, no matter how partisan things get, they do tend to keep their mouths shut. And they did. Chris Murphy, not surprisingly, is leading the condemnation of this. He can do that. But at this point, is that really advised or warranted? You tell me. But we start with this today. Again, there are going to be no right and wrong answers about this. Because, look, the White House is already saying, well, this could go 4 to 5 weeks. Now, if they're saying 4 to 5 weeks, if that's what they are saying, 4 to 5 weeks, are they thinking double that? I don't know. Or is that on the high end? And they think it could be 2 or 3 weeks. But again, none of us know the answers to this. What I do know is this could be, I don't think there's going to be a middle ground here. This could be a big success, all things considered. Or have we now embarked? And I'm not trying to be hyperbolic saying this. I'm not trying to, you know, stoke the fires. I can't believe you said that. No, seriously, you have, with the amount of other nations already involved here, if you have a functioning brain, you have to consider the question as to whether or not World War III has just begun.
We're engaged in regular, ongoing military strikes that has already killed American soldiers with the goal of regime change. If that is not war, what is?
All right. Probably the most vocal of the Connecticut congressional delegation yesterday on CBS on Face the Nation with Margaret Brennan. That, of course, Connecticut U.S. Senator Chris Murphy, the other members of Connecticut's delegation taking a bit more of a muted approach to this, although it's been universally panned. I want to make a quick correction before we go to our guest here. I mentioned the Gang of Eight. Yes, four of them are on the House and Senate Intelligence Committees. I mistakenly said the other four were from the Homeland Security Committees in the House and Senate. They are not. They are just the regular House leaders, which would be Mike Johnson and Hakeem Jeffries and John Thune and Chuck Schumer in the Senate. All right, to one of our favorite guests now to explain all the intricacies of the Middle East here. Welcoming back University of New Haven, Professor of National Security, Dr. Howard Stouffer, to the program. Dr. Stouffer, it's Paul again. Thanks for joining us. How are you?
Thank you. I'm fine. Glad to be back.
I can imagine the thoughts you have, Dr. Stouffer, must be many right now. Give us your overview here over the past 3 or 4 days. Are you surprised by this, Dr. Stouffer, or not?
Well, it depends on where you say surprised. I was surprised on Friday night, Saturday morning, waking up early. just to look at my phone, and I saw that we were at we were fighting Iran. So I was surprised. I thought they would take a little more time, another week, and see if the technical talks would produce any results in Vienna that they had talked about last Thursday. So that was a surprise.
Mm-hmm.
Whether we're attacking Iran or not, I'm not surprised. I think this president has just decided that, you know, they are a threat, and they've been a threat to the United States for a long time. And so I think what we got now is, you know, there's a constitutional question about, you know, engaging in war under the War Powers Act, under the Constitution without a declaration of any kind or action by Congress. The other thing is, how should we react to what's going on against Iran? And I want to just take a moment to say,
sure,
these are the people who took 52 hostages from our embassy and held them for 444 days. These are the people who basically have helped the Iraqis shape bombs, road bombs, so that our soldiers got killed, you know, quite a lot. Quite a few of them were maimed and injured and killed by these road bombs that they helped shape and form for the Iraqi regime under Saddam Hussein. These are the people that wouldn't give their own people, you know, the American and British vaccinations in order to deal with COVID. So 140,000 of their own people died. These are the same people that have allowed air pollution to be so severe that now 59,000 people have died from air pollution over the last 5 years in Iraq. And these are the same people that have, you know, indiscriminately had Hezbollah, Hamas, and the Houthis just attack Israeli civilians, not Israeli military targets, but Israeli civilians over the years. And so for the payback now that's taking place with the United States together with Israel, it seems appropriate, whether it's legal, whether it's, you know, the right procedure, that's a whole different question. But whether these are the people that should be receiving, these being the leadership and the military of Iraq, should be receiving, you know, this action from the United States and Israel, perfectly justified.
I, Dr. Stouffer, was just mesmerized over the weekend, as maybe you were, with the videos coming not just in major cities around the world, but in Iran itself, of people. Now, I know the celebrations are one thing and getting governance is another, but people, literally, some people crying, they were so happy, and the dancing in the street and the waving of the pre-Islamic revolution flag. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I really hope that, you know, for all of the celebrations elsewhere, that the Iranian people, many of whom I didn't even mention, I'm sorry, that somewhere around, you know, 32 to 40,000 people were killed by this regime in January and February when they were protesting against the regime and demanding that some kind of change take place because, you know, students and workers have nowhere to go, nothing to do. Their futures are completely governed by these rich members of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps who've made millions of dollars off of the riches of the country in selling oil, and everybody else is basically barely getting by. So there have been these huge protests. They've just shot them down. They brought in Hezbollah people from, you know, the ranks of the Lebanese Hezbollah to come in and kill all of these people that just, you know, in the streets with, you know, shooting them down in row after row. Another 20,000 are still sitting in jails being tortured. You know, we have to take all of that into account, you know, and I hope that the Iranian people now will see that this is more than just regime change. Khomeini is dead. This is a situation where there is a fundamental turn in the Middle East, and it always goes like that. The Middle East always has everything goes along the same, and then suddenly there's a major shift. And so this is one of those major shifts, and they need to take the reins in hand. They need to go into the streets. They need to protest. And there are leaders among the students and among all those workers who have been fighting the regime all these years and all these months. And hopefully somebody there will rise up and demonstrate that they can take over the country and lead it in a democratic way.
Dr. Howard Stouffer is the guest from the University of New Haven. Always love to tap in on his vast knowledge. Dr. Stouffer, you mentioned the IRGC. Are they maybe the key here? And do you think of the how many, half a million, whoever's in there, what kind of level of allegiance do they have? Or if they see this situation going on for another 2 to 3 weeks, do they turn? Do they desert? Do they say, all right, listen, this is enough. We get the message here. This is not going to work. Or will they fight to the death?
It might be something in between that.
Yeah.
You know, you have to remember that the Israelis and the Americans are focusing some of the bombing, not just on the missiles and missile launchers, but they're focusing on the IRGC, the Revolutionary Guard Corps.
Mm-hmm.
And they want to kill as many of them as possible because they're the ones that have let this regime go through all of these activities that led to thousands of people getting killed.
Yeah.
The other thing to remember, though, is that inside Iran, and it's often not reported, that there is a system called the BAYT, B-A-Y-T.
Mm-hmm.
And the BAYT is a system where the Ayatollah was at the head of it, and his four sons were in charge of it. And there were about 400 people who were the principal officers. And then there were 40,000 people who watched over the IRGC and all of the police and all of the intelligence services to make sure they were carrying out the orders and the policies of the Ayatollah. So there's this system still out there, and who knows where they can be found. So many of these people in the IRGC, maybe they'll be seeing the writing on the wall, but, you know, the political commissars that the Soviet Union have, they're still watching them.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure how that's going to come about. I mean, some of them might very well throw down their arms and try to blend in. Most of them will probably still be engaged in believing they can resist the United States at this point and the Israelis. And I think they're going to find, as the president said, the big wave still hasn't even arrived. Obviously, we're shipping a lot more arms without saying what they are, but I'm sure it could be even another aircraft carrier, but certainly aircraft are coming in. And the president has not removed the possibility, which I hope he wouldn't do, but the possibility of putting boots on the ground. So all of that indicates to me that this is going to be an operation that is going to wipe out the IRGC. If you're in the IRGC, you better start thinking about, well, where can I go and be safe? Because some of them, you know, depending on how committed they are, they might just, you know, like you say, would fight until they're, you know, destroyed or killed.
Mm.
It's just, but I think it's going to take several more days for them to realize how massive these attacks are. I mean, there have been thousands and thousands of sorties now.
Yeah.
And the missile launchers are fanning out. They're not launching as many missiles as they thought they had.
Dr. Stouffer, final question in about the minute we have. The surrounding nations, many of whom are absorbing hits from Iran, are they happy with this? Do they now have the imprimatur? Are they going to look at it to say, enough is enough for all these years, we're going to join in here, or what?
Well, the best country to look at is Qatar, because Qatar was always the intermediary between the Americans and the Iranians. The Qataris have been now struck by missiles and by drones. Even though they were going after the American base, they struck their LNG facility, the liquefied natural gas. And so they said, we're shutting that down. And, you know, the Kuwaitis had one of their most beautiful hotels, 7-star hotels, that was, you know, attacked. The Bahrainis had apartment buildings attacked. The UAE had that sale type of hotel, 7-star hotel, that was on fire. So they're attacking more than just U.S. bases. And if there are mistakes as they fire their missiles and drones and they're hitting things that they shouldn't be hitting, I think all the countries in the Gulf and the British are now on board. The British are now giving access to Diego Garcia, and because they got hit in Cyprus. So I think things – so some in the media will say this is a widening war. I think what this is that the Iranians don't realize how they're focusing the efforts of the Gulf states to work with the Americans and these – not so much the Israelis, but with the Americans to eliminate this regime and this threat that's hung over them for almost half a century.
Dr. Howard Stouffer, University of New Haven Professor of National Security. As always, Doctor, we value your insights. Thank you, sir, and I'm sure we'll be talking in a few days again. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Appreciate it, Dr. Howard Stouffer. There you go. If you are a legal gun owner in Connecticut, or maybe you've applied to be one, thank you for following the law. And if you are doing either one of those things and you like to partake of marijuana, which, of course, is legal here in Connecticut, various THC products, you should listen up to this one. There is a key Supreme Court case going on right now, could affect you here in Connecticut and folks all over the country, connected to marijuana and guns, even if you think you're doing both legally. And you talk about strange political bedfellows on this one. Landmark Legal Foundation VP of Legal Affairs Mike O'Neill joins us whenever there's something to do with the Supreme Court. He's one of the guys we go to. Hey, Mike, it's Paul. Good afternoon. How are you?
Good. How are you, Paul? Good afternoon.
I'm good. And Mike, explain this case to us. And when I saw some of the interest groups banding together on this, I'm saying to myself, well, isn't this interesting? So go ahead. What's up here?
Right. You're going to get marijuana advocates and Second Amendment advocates and libertarians together. And I think you're going to see, you saw that cross-pollination in some of the oral arguments today.
Okay. Yep.
So the Supreme Court was hearing oral arguments in a case called United States versus Hamani. And this involves what you just said. There's a federal law on the books that prohibits anybody who uses an illicit substance from owning a firearm.
Mm-hmm.
So that means under federal law, marijuana is still considered illegal. There's a discrepancy there, right? Many states in our country, of course, have legalized the purchase and use of marijuana. The federal government hasn't yet to do that. So under this law, and this individual, Mr. Hamani, was apprehended. The FBI was executing a search warrant. They found a firearm, and they also found marijuana. And he said he was a regular user. Now, keep in mind, under the facts of this case, he was not high at the time.
Okay.
He wasn't waving his gun around and he was high. He was simply admitted that he was a regular user and that he was in possession of a firearm, and therefore he was prosecuted under this law.
Wow.
Now, of course, the Fifth Circuit overruled and said that this infringed upon his lawyers proffered the argument that this law violated the Second Amendment, and the Fifth Circuit agreed, and so it was tossed out. But then, of course, it was appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court, who heard oral arguments today. And so they're going to decide the propriety of this. Now, again, the issue here is whether the Second Amendment's protections extend to Mr. Hamani and those of his ilk, those who regularly use marijuana, and not being high and using a firearm, whether they're just by usage of their regular usage of marijuana prohibits them from owning a firearm, and does that federal law violate the Second Amendment?
So there's no allegation here, Mike, just so people listening to us now who happen to be legal gun owners here in the state who may, you know, on a weekend, they're watching a game, you have a little CBD product. So we're not talking about somebody who was waving the gun, threatening people, and then failed a THC blood draw. This is a guy who apparently was upfront about this, right?
I don't know whether he was upfront about it, but he did admit, you know, obviously it wasn't a fact in dispute that he was a regular user. Now, it was interesting that the when you're talking about these Second Amendment cases, now this goes back from Bruin, which is a recent decision from the court, which dictates that when you're trying to discern what the contours of the Second Amendment are, you're going to look at history and tradition during the founding era. So inevitably in these oral arguments, you get these funny anecdotes. Where the government was defending itself, saying, "Look, back in the founding era, there were laws that were passed that could prohibit habitual drunkards from owning firearms."
Really?
So of course, that spurred an argument about what's a habitual drunkard, and Justice Gorsuch really kind of discerned it and said, "Well, keep in mind here, if you really look at." It took a lot to be a habitual drunkard.
Yeah,
James Madison back in the founding era would have a pint of whiskey, or John Adams would have, you know, gallons of hard cider. If you look at it's funny if you ever look at the bill of fare for George Washington.
Oh yes, oh my God, and I'm like, this can't be real. Yes, it is.
Right. So it's a high threshold about that kind of got the government in a little bit of trouble, because conceding what a habitual drunkard is isn't certainly a recreation. You can't really analogize a habitual drunkard in the founding era to a regular, a kind of a quasi-regular occasional user of marijuana. So it really doesn't kind of jibe. So the government's arguments trying to defend this law in the context of a founding era discussion got a little bit off track. Now we could talk about the justices.
Yeah. What did you sense from what you heard?
Yeah. Yeah. I think, politics makes strange bedfellows here. I think you're going to see, you know, Justice Gorsuch, as I was just indicating, was kind of delving into that habitual drunkard. He's more along the libertarian section. So I think he's probably one to uphold the protections of the Second Amendment and find that this law violates the Second Amendment. I think you saw Justices Kagan and Sotomayor kind of sympathizing with, you know, somebody, a user of marijuana who might be unfairly prosecuted.
Yeah.
And understanding maybe the bigger implications here, maybe 50 million people, you know, regularly use marijuana in a lot of legal states. And then you saw that Amy Coney Barrett again and Justice Kavanaugh were kind of understanding, going back to their Bruin roots, saying, look, the historical tradition, history and tradition of this Second Amendment analysis doesn't really jibe up. And you saw maybe Thomas was even part of that, too. So it was an interesting thing. I think Roberts and Alito were the ones who expressed the most skepticism. Roberts is always one to defer to the political branches in these instances, even though you could probably argue that this law, as it's crafted, and we're seeing how it's applied in this instance, is maybe too broadly crafted.
Yeah.
Maybe the law could be, you know, prohibits from users, or instead of marijuana, maybe harder drugs, you know, heroin, cocaine, specified drugs as opposed to just illicit substances. Maybe the language in the statute's too vague, and kick it back to Congress to kind of, if they want to deny firearms to drug users, you know, maybe specify what kinds of drugs in the statute, maybe be a little more specific.
Excellent. Mike O'Neill, Landmark Legal Foundation, VP of Legal Affairs. Mike, thanks. As always, we appreciate the time, my friend. Take care.
Always fun. Take care.
All right, thanks. So there you go, folks. Let's get a little update from the Capitol right now. We've had this gentleman on a while from the Republican caucus. State Rep Greg Howard, Ledyard, North Stonington. Greg always brings good stuff to the table, so we'll get an update from him right now. Hey, Greg, it's Paul again. How are you, sir?
Good evening, sir. Thanks so much for having me. How are you?
I'm good, and we should mention Greg is a practicing police officer, active duty police officer. Greg, I had no idea how fast I was going. Really, there was no way I was. How often do you hear that, Greg? Right, officer? I had no idea I was doing 85, right?
Right, yeah, exactly. Nobody ever knows what they're doing, right?
Hey, Greg, sure. there's that little thing called a speedometer. You just got to look down. You can see it right there, right?
Right, yeah. Actually, most modern cars actually gives it a speed limit right on the screen, too, so you can see both. And it goes red if you're above. That's what I'm told. I've never done it, Paul. That's what I'm told.
Oh, okay. All right, Greg, this big omnibus bill. Now, first of all, what have you guys heard and gals? Has the governor signed this yet? Do we know? And what about his notion that, Greg, he may do some line item vetoing thing, because the word on the street was he wasn't real happy with some of these earmarks in light of what's going on with at least one Democratic caucus member in the Senate.
Yeah, I mean, there's, you know, two major chunks of this bill. I mean, this is a 121 omnibus bill, and mm-hmm. I'd really like to talk about how it came to be. But, you know, you're talking about 98 sections, and if there's a bunch about education. There's some other miscellaneous things. But, yeah, the earmarks are an issue. And with all that's going on with earmarks, you know, the Republican caucus and the House leader, specifically Vin Candelora, and the Republican leader, Steve Harding, both have pushed the governor to line item veto that. Because, you know, Senator Sampson asked Senator Austin right in the debate, who asked for these earmarks and what are they for? She's a proponent of the legislation, and she doesn't know. So, and to your point, you know, there's one senator who is under investigation now, and you know, there's earmarks for an entity that he works for.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we hear optics all the time out there. Well, the optics are bad. Mm. Well, the optics of this are terrible. I mean, it's just awful. And to be doing it in you know, in general is a problem, I think, but to be doing it in the manner in which this bill came to be through a lack of process, frankly, I think is even more concerning.
You know, Greg, you just mentioned Kathy Austin, who was a longtime, well-respected, you know, Democratic legislator who represents a big chunk of, you know, where you're from, out in the eastern part of the state. She's very influential, very well-respected. But, Greg, I don't know how you guys and gals do it up there when you ask somebody, well, where are these earmarks from or were they for? And somebody... and I don't doubt her honesty here when questioning back and forth says, well, we don't know. I mean, how do you not know? I mean, most people.
Well, because that's what they said, the quiet part out loud, Paul.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the big issue. Right. So, you know, I've watched people in this state walk around holding signs, no kings, no oligarchies. Right. Well, an oligarchy, by definition, is just a few people running the government.
Yeah.
So if you take a look at this piece of legislation, this Senate Bill 298 that we passed this week, and you look at the process that goes on, and you take Kathy's response to that, or Senator Austin's response to that, what you're understanding is that really the governor, the president pro tem of the Senate, and the speaker are running the state, and that's the real problem, right? And that. So you have the Senate Chair of Appropriations who says, I don't know. She said, yo, I don't know. But what she's essentially saying is, I don't know. That's what the leaders told me we were putting in here.
Yeah.
That's it. You know, and she's quoted in an article months ago when the investigation first came up on McCrory saying that looks like a list that came from leadership. So what they're telling you is you have leaders in Hartford on the Democrat side because they hold a majority, and whoever their friends are that want certain money, they just come to them and then they get it, and nobody really asks any questions. Well, I mean, the Republicans ask questions, but yeah, naturally, you know, the we don't get answers. So
yeah. Greg, I shudder to ask this, but what's up next? I'm seeing things
and the reason is because, you know, Paul, for years I've been up there, five years, and I said, you know what, the sanctity of the institution is paramount in Connecticut. Mm-hmm. That's why we don't function like we do in Washington, D.C. But when this bill comes out, right, and you got the four Democrat leaders, the president pro tem of the Senate, the majority leader of the House, and the Speaker, come out with this omnibus bill. Yeah. And I think folks should understand this. In statute, in 2-26 of our general statutes, and this is a statute that was enacted, I think, in 1955, and it's been modified a couple of times, 74, 2011, most recently in 2011, to bring it up to date. And it's a statute that basically says that a paper copy of a bill has to be on a legislator's desk within 48 hours of a vote.
Yeah.
Except, and that's in 2011, that became electronic, right, because we're updating with the times. But it basically says it has to. However, it acknowledges that the Speaker of the House and the President pro tem of the Senate can bypass that, and in doing so will bypass the public hearing process, the community input, et cetera, when it necessitates an immediate vote. We call that an emergency certification, right?
Yeah.
So we just had a once-in-50-year snowstorm, right? We got pummeled down here, by the way. I know. I think we got a lot more than you guys did, actually. But we got pummeled down here in southeastern Connecticut. So, for example, if we have a public safety risk with snow piled up at intersections and schools and whatnot, and said, hey, we need to pass a bill to, you know, because it's illegal to dump that snow into the river, say, we need to pass a bill to temporarily allow that for this particular storm.
Yeah.
That sort of stuff. You know, even when they ran the legislation the day after opening day saying we have to run an emergency certification to allow the governor to spend money in case money anticipated out of Washington, D.C. doesn't make it because of federal shutdowns. Like, I didn't agree with their argument, but there's an argument to be made there, right? But when you look at this, the intent of that statute was to for the legislature to be able to convene and pass a bill that is necessary to do right now.
Mm-hmm.
There is 98 sections of this bill, 95% of which there's not even an argument to be made. For example, I'll give you a quick examples if you don't mind humoring me.
Yeah.
Because it's not really about the policy, right?
Yeah.
We got legislation in here that says that for next school year, which starts in September, right? But, you know, 8 months from now, six months from now, that starts in September, students do certain things to get a seal of civics literacy on their diploma.
Okay.
We're in session now. That bill, we could have passed that bill in 3 weeks through the process like normal. No big deal. Not going to change anything. You know, that's one of them.
Mm-hmm.
And there's several like that. There's actually, if you look at Section 26 of the bill, it changes a bunch of stuff about kindergarten admission. And then, I'm not kidding, Section 27 repeals Section 26 right in the same bill. I mean, it's outrageous. And then then you look at it, and some of the most offensive things, by the way, is, you know, last year, folks have been complaining about their public benefits charge now for years.
Oh, God.
Right? So last year, we put a new public benefit charge in your cell phone bill now. It's a five-cent charge.
Yeah.
And at the end of the regular session, I was opposed to it, not opposed to the spending because the funding is for cancer relief for firefighters who are at a higher risk for cancer. I support that, but let's do it in the budget. Let's be transparent about it. Let's not hide it in a cell phone bill like we do with our Eversource bills, right?
Like we don't do that enough. Yeah.
The advocates come to me and say, Greg, we understand your concern. If you don't block the bill, sure, you're going to vote no because it's a hidden tax and you're against hidden taxes.
Yeah.
But if you don't block the bill, we're going to put an opt-out in there. So unlike the public benefits, you know, customers can write to the cell phone company and say, hey, I don't want to pay this 5 cents, and they can get out of it. Okay. I said, all right, that seems pretty fair. Now folks have a decision to make. They want to do it, they can, they don't have to. This is America, what a beautiful thing, right? Well, we pass it that way. Sure enough, we come into a special session in the fall, and they get rid of the opt-out. Now, in this bill, it's an emergency now.
Yeah.
Instead of that legislation coming to fruition in January, so you would start to see those 5 cent charges in your cell phone bill beginning in January, it's an emergency now.
Yeah.
We're moving it back to July 1st.
Greg, I don't know how you do it. Greg Howard. Greg, thanks, man. Keep up the good fight, and we'll chat down the road. Appreciate it, man. Thanks.
Thanks, guys. Have a great day.
All right, be good. Greg Howard there.